hello everyone, and thank you for joining us, whether you're watching on video or listening on our podcast show. And welcome to our Legal Insight. I'm Jill Bloom, publisher of Roofing Contractor, Walls and Ceilings, and Building Enclosure. And with me today is Art Eisner, the editor of Roofing Contractor. And we are so honored to be joined by our legal expert, Trent Cotney, the CEO of Cotney Attorneys and Consultants. Trent, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey guys, great to be here.
It is great to be here for sure. So Trent, I want to start off by talking about the ETS, the standard that put in place, and then it looks like OSHA suspended it as soon as we talked about it last time. And then there's been some other confusing things that have happened. So can you kind of walk us through what do contractors need to know? And
We talked a lot about what the ETS is. I'm not going to talk about that. It's on the podcast. You're welcome to go check out the video, listen to it. What I want to do is I want to update everybody since last time we talked. So this thing came out on November 5th, right? It's about 500 pages. I remember it because I was in the Indianapolis airport when it came out and my phone started lighting up and I said, oh God, I got to read this quickly and try to figure out what's going on. That next day, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one step lower than the Supreme Court, issued a temporary stay saying that they believe that there were significant issues legally with that. Okay. And the following week, there was an opportunity for OSHA to reply to that and then the petitioner to also submit a response. And ultimately, on November 12th, the Fifth Circuit reaffirmed their initial stay. And what's really interesting is if you read that opinion, it's scathing. I mean, they lit OSHA up. I mean, what they said is not only was the OSHA ETS under-inclusive because, you know, it doesn't account for, you know, employers that have under 100 employees, but it was also over-inclusive in that it didn't carve out enough exceptions for certain types of workplaces. And it said, look, in order to have an emergency temporary standard, you have to be able to show that there's grave danger. And there's enough here to where we don't know for certain, but it looks to me like we need to put a temporary stay on. So they issued that stay. After that, keep in mind that there were 34 separate cases that had been filed in almost every single circuit that's out there. So what happens when you have that is you have a lottery. And literally what they do is they get a giant tumbler and they put a bunch of ping pong balls in there and they draw which circuit is going to hear the case. Well, in this instance, what happened is that tumbler went through and the Sixth Circuit is the one that got that case. What's interesting about the Sixth Circuit, which includes, you know, Tennessee, Ohio, and some other states, is that a lot of the judges that were appointed there were appointed by Republican presidents. So it doesn't necessarily mean one way or the other, but you would anticipate they're probably a little bit more conservative. I had the opportunity to reach out to a former clerk of the Sixth Circuit, and I talked to him and I asked him, well, what do you think is going to happen here? And he said, what they might do is they're probably going to forego a traditional three-judge panel, and they're going to do what's known as an en banc hearing, which means basically they invite all the sitting judges for that circuit to hear. And the reason they're going to do that is that it expedites it and it gets it in front of the Supreme Court even quicker. So timetable, I get asked that a lot. I would anticipate that we're going to hear something here from the Sixth Circuit this week or next week. Okay, and I could be wrong, but that's my guess. As far as the Supreme Court, when are we going to get a final decision? Definitely after the December 5th deadline. Okay, if you remember, there were a bunch of things that you had to comply with by December 5th, and then by January 4th, you got to start testing unvaccinated employees. It could go beyond that January 4th deadline as well. Okay, so probably my guess is probably won't hear something until January. The question that I get asked, Jill and Art, is what do I do? Do I still need to comply with this? Okay, as a lawyer, that puts me in a tough spot because legally what I want to say is, well, it ain't over till it's over. You know, until you get a definitive decision, you should anticipate compliance. But I can tell you that based on everything that I've seen, based on my understanding of the law and the review of at least the initial opinions out of the Fifth Circuit, I find it highly unlikely that this OSHA ETS will survive judicial scrutiny. That being said, okay, if I am an employer, there are some certain things that you might want to consider doing, because even if this thing doesn't survive, you may be in a situation where your customers are asking you for the same type of information. So there's absolutely no issue with you creating a ledger that determines which of your employees are vaccinated and which are not. That's probably a good thing to have regardless. There's nothing wrong with getting proof of vaccination for those that have been vaccinated. You might be on a job that requires that. There's nothing wrong with putting a voluntary vaccination policy in place where you might want to incentivize certain people for doing it. There's nothing wrong with that. And all those things you might want to consider. I do think that based on what OSHA said, as soon as the Fifth Circuit issued their stay, OSHA said, we are not going to enforce this pending any of these cases. Okay. And what that means to me is that pending the ultimate conclusion all the way through the U.S. Supreme Court. So it is highly, highly unlikely that December 5th or that January 4th deadline will stick, even if for some reason the court, you know, blesses it and say, yes, this is great, great regulation, which again, I kind of question. So, as legally, all I can do is say it's still on the books technically until they say it's not. From a business perspective, there's probably some things you can do to help prepare yourself in the future. But I don't think the OSHA ETS, the way it's written, will stand.
So if I'm an employer and can I still mandate vaccinations, even though they
just... So very interesting question, Jill. Around the same time, so again, after we talked last time, Governor DeSantis signed some legislation, and this legislation was, he had banned vaccine mandates before. He had said no business can mandate a vaccine in the state of Florida, but this time he added some significant teeth to it. So he said, for larger employers, it could be $50,000 per employee, and for smaller ones, $10,000 per employee. As a result, Disney World backed off its mandatory vaccination policy. So the question becomes, who wins the day? Let's say the OSHA ETS survives. Historically, federal law trumps state law, okay? And OSHA federal law trumps any state version that's contrary. What's interesting here, what's different about this one, is the right to regulate business. It normally falls within the state, right? The Commerce Clause and the ability to deal with interstate activities falls within the state. This rule implicates that because it affects employers and the right to do business in the state. So in states like Texas and Florida that have banned vaccines, you've got a very interesting dynamic. Keep in mind that the OSHA ETS does not mandate vaccines, okay? It doesn't require you get vaccinated. It says you have an opportunity to test, but really, in my opinion, this new OSHA standard is not a safety standard. It is really a quasi, you better get vaccinated, otherwise there's a heavy administrative cost and penalty associated with it. Very, very interesting. A lot of complex legal issues. This is, this is like one of those law exam questions I had back in law school. You're having to bring up all this stuff from, constitutional arguments and everything else, but that's where we stand as of today. It could be different tomorrow, but that's what we're looking at right now.
Fabulous. Well, Trent, so it sounds like we could be breaking some legal precedent once this thing all gets worked out one way or the other. So I did just want to, reiterate. So those key deadlines, those still remain in effect, and it is kind of a wait and see. We'll see what progresses with the courts in terms of the actual, stay or not. I was going to ask, what will you tell contractors if they do start getting nicked by some enforcement of this after those deadlines?
So the two critical deadlines are December 5th, and that's to get all your policies, your documentation, pretty much almost everything in the rule with the exception of mandatory testing, which is January 4th. OSHA has said it will not look to implement, enforce, do anything with the rule as long as the cases are pending, okay? So again, I think it is highly unlikely that this thing will run its way all the way through the Supreme Court by January 4th. It's possible, okay? And if that happens, if for some reason, and this is a lot of ifs, if for some reason the court says, yes, this is 100% legit, move forward, then it's possible that a government agency should say, yes, these are the deadlines. But historically, that doesn't happen. Okay, historically, if you look at the federal contractor vaccine mandate, they've moved the deadlines from December 8th to January 4th, January 18th, and they're not under the same type of legal challenge. So even if the worst case happens, historically, what agencies do is they give both the public and OSHA a time to ramp up, and more than likely, those deadlines will be pushed. It's not a given, but that's more than likely. So, you know, when contractors are faced with this issue, so let's say for some reason they are cited. Let me give you a great example, Art, because I think this will hit home. Okay, I had a contractor call me and they said, Trent, you know, there's this outdoor worker exclusion. I want to use it, but my workers use crew caps and they're company crew caps. If I have them wear a mask, can I still use the exception? The answer is no, you can't. But from a defense standpoint, if I'm cited for violating that law, right, but I'm making my workers wear masks and socially distance when they're not wearing masks and they're otherwise outdoor workers, is that an enforceable citation? As a defense, I would say no, it's not, because alternative means were used that still achieve the same level of safety. That's the big issue. And that's one of the issues I think a lot of these courts are struggling with, is there are alternative means to keep people safe. You know, one, there's a question is this a grave and imminent threat that is normally required for an ETS? I don't think it is. And two is you're not taking into account all the stuff that we've been doing for a year and a half now, right? Everybody's washing their hands, using sanitizer, wearing masks, social distance. There's no reason why you can't still engage in that and be safe without, you know, necessarily falling into the letter of this law as it's written. So if a contractor was cited, I would have about 25 pages worth of defenses. And I had an honest conversation with an area director the other day. And I just said off the record, what do you think about this? And he said, I hate it. Most people in OSHA, if you talk to them, they dislike this because they recognize they'd already gone through this analysis last year and determined that only healthcare needed it. And the second thing is they don't want people like me just chewing them alive with defenses and everything else every time they're cited. They want to get the easy kills. They don't want to have to make case law every time they cite somebody for this. So there's just a lot of issues. You know, it's the government is a giant beast in there, and it affects so many different parts of it. You've got, you know, legislation going into effect. You got the judicial branch, you got executive agency branch, you've got the Biden administration doing stuff. It is unprecedented. I haven't seen anything this, let me put it this way. I haven't seen anything like this OSHA ETS that is this onerous in this short amount of time that is being forced on employers. It's absolutely incredible.
Well, Trent, so in some of the ideas you mentioned, some of those proactive steps that contractors can take, do you believe things like that, creating a registry or having a voluntary vaccination policy in place, can those potentially create enough cover for contractors that might be worried? You know what I mean? Will they get good credit for trying to do something?
Yeah, I think, look, if it's like I said, every time I do a webinar, the party with the best picker wins of the day, right? If you are taking steps to keep your workplace safe, right? OSHA is always looking for a culture of safety. So if you're properly identifying who's vaccinated and who's not, if you know, there are some contractors that have, look, if you're not vaccinated, you got to wear a mask indoors. You know, some governments require that, right? If you're following whatever those policies and procedures are, if you're engaging in education on that, if you're giving people the opportunity to get vaccinated if they want to, if you are, you know, encouraging people to get tested and making sure that they remove themselves from the workplace in the event that they have symptoms, all that stuff goes to the ultimate culpability or violation of this emergency temporary standard. There, like I said, there are huge legal holes in this. You know, I was salivating as I was reading this in the airport and on the way back, because I was already thinking about all the different ways I could punch a hole in this. And that's the same thing that this assistant area director told me. He's like, yeah, I don't want to deal with you guys. You know, I that's not what I'm in the business of, you know, safety I don't want to have to make new law. This has got some issues, you know. So I think even they recognize it.
All right. Switching gears a little bit, the Department of Labor also announced a final rule increasing minimum wage for federal contracts to $15 beginning next year. Do you expect that to have an impact on the industry one way or the other?
No, because look, I can go work at Target or Chick-fil-A for $15 an hour now. So on federal projects, they tend to be higher compensated. So I think I'd be surprised if anybody's paying anybody on a federal project $15 an hour at this point. That being said, I think, you know, with inflation pretty much out of control now, you can expect that 15 to turn into 17 pretty quick. You know, it's hard to find low end workers. And the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of federal projects is governed by Davis-Bacon Wage Act. So usually those are prevailing wages, union type wages. They differ depending on geographic region, but they're elevated wages to begin with. So I think it's more political than it is impactful. You know, I do think that in order for the roofing industry and, you know, construction in general to be able to attract labor, they're going to have to raise prices. You know, that is the only, you want to know the biggest way to get more workers in the workforce, pay them more. That's just it. Cause we're competing with other industries and other trades that aren't as onerous. So you've got to, you know, you got to incentivize them. You got to pay better. And that's the quickest way to solve the problem.
True enough. You did mention politics. Anything else, you know, coming your way from activity on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, so the infrastructure plan passed. You know, it was a gutted plan from 3.5, you know, trillion to roughly 1.2. But there are some interesting nuggets in there. You know, I question whether or not this is a good move. I mean, I agree that we need some infrastructure improvement, but I am very, very concerned about inflation and dumping more money into an overstimulated economy. I have a problem as a fiscal conservative, you know, personally. I just wonder whether or not this is good timing. That being said, the money's being allocated to, most of the money is bridges and roads. There are a lot that's going to ports and airports and to increase broadband capability. From a construction standpoint, they have talked specifically about some renewable energy and, you know, increasing electric vehicle availability. Another thing that's very interesting, you know, I was reading the other day that a lot of the major car manufacturers are moving away from, you know, gasoline-driven vehicles. We're going to have a metals crisis here pretty soon, because we do not have the metals capable to create these batteries and other things that are needed. What you probably will see is a big political push to go 100%, but then reality will probably kick in and it will take longer. In addition to that, there was some changes to construction material purchasing. They wanted to incentivize, Buy American for steel and some other things. But once you read down into it, there's a lot of carve outs. There's a lot of ways to get around that. Overall, look, I do think we need some infrastructure improvement. You know, I definitely think, especially with, you know, some of the stuff they're doing with airports and bridges and even the broadband aspect. But my concern, overall concern, is inflation, you know. And to get back to what I said about wages, that's going to keep happening. You know, we're going to have to keep paying more to keep up with what the increased prices are. And if we're not doing that, then other trades are going to start taking more of our workers. So it's something long-term I think we need to continue to look at. I pray there isn't any more things with a trillion at the end coming up, because it doesn't concern me, but you know, I look at my son, I'm like, guess what? You're going to be paying for this. So.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot more use of that word than just even 10 years ago. So,
right.
Scary stuff, I guess. Jill, back to you.
Yes, there's no doubt inflation. I have a friend of mine who's in LA this week, and I got a picture texted to me. Gasoline was well above $6 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
So, what? Anything else making your phone ring?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was over at Western States, and we were in California, and I went to go fill up, and I just about collapsed when I saw it was in the $5 range. I couldn't believe it, you know. You know, as we start getting into the holidays and as we kind of move forward, the materials issue continues to morph. You know, we're all keenly aware of what the issues are, how to protect ourselves in contracts, everything else. But what's become interesting is how this has shifted away from what the problem is to what the real underlying issues are. And that is trucking and shipping and a lot of these other things. So one of the things that we're keenly watching, there's a House bill. It's the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. I believe it's a step in the right direction, because what it does is it eases a lot of the bureaucracy and red tape that our ports currently experience. And I think, you know, there's no magic wand that will suddenly resolve every single problem. But I think we got to start somewhere. And I like what I'm seeing in that act. That's something that I think ultimately, and it's gaining support as we continue to look at stuff like that, whether it's trucking or shipping or our ports, we got to solve that problem, because this shows how all this is broken down. I mean, I went, you know, Christmas shopping this weekend, and I was surprised how many of the shelves were, you know, not completely full, or things I was looking for were gone. And it's, you know, that stuff's only going to continue. I think is we can expect that it'll be this way through next year. So look for more legislation like that. I anticipate that, you know, not only the Ocean Shipping Reform Act, but there's going to be other things that help to address our logistics problems.
Fabulous. Well, Trent, thank you so much for your time. As always, we appreciate it. I know the contractors out there appreciate it as well. If anybody has any questions for Trent, you can reach him at cotneycl.com. If you have any questions for us, reach out to us at roofingcontractor.com, wconline.com, or buildingenclosureonline.com. But bottom line, please stay safe and healthy. We look forward to talking to you next time.